Blog Talk Radio.
Finest people. Where is thy salute?
For presenting yourselves on this battlefield. I give you thanks.
This is our army. To join it, you give homage.
I give homage to Scotland. And if this is your army, why does it go?
We didn't come here to fight for them.
Oh, the English are too many.
I am William Wallace.
William Wallace is 7 feet tall.
Yes, I've heard. Killed men by the hundreds. And if he were here, he'd consume the English with fireballs from his eyes and bolts of lightning from his arms. I am William Wallace. And I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny. You've come to fight as free men. And free men you are. What will you do without freedom? Will you fight?
Fight against that? No! We will run!
And we will live.
Aye. Fight and you may die. Run and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your bed, many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
The New World Order, I've analyzed it from every angle. I've analyzed every facet of it. They are not going to be able to get away with getting the New World Order off the ground. There is no way that they are going to be able to set up this open world government, openly ruled by a private banking cartel that taxes and regulates every facet of our lives without staging terror or a huge war. Period. And again, thousands of pieces of data and research going to people ask me, well, how do you know this? How do you understand this? You just have to have your head in the game 15, 16, 17, 18 hours a day studying the enemy to be able to understand the basics. Or many of you that have been listening to this show for many years, or who have worked in government, or who are historians in your own right, who have been doing some of the same research, you understand why. And, you know, I can oversimplify all of it, but there's just so many nuances that add into the total.
Y'all been asking where the Trump supporters are, right? Why have we been so quiet? Where all the Trumpies at, right? That's what I've been hearing. We've been here the whole time. We don't need a safe space. We don't burn down our cities. We don't riot when things don't go our way. And if we lose a fair one, then we accept defeat with humility. But when you try to run...
Blowout, number three.
Get your pitch to zero.
everybody. Joseph Gibson podcasting here, live late show tonight. Figured I got in a little bit late. I was supposed to do one earlier, but I figured I had what the heck. I better do it, especially since we're going on iTunes there, Apple, Stitcher. Oh, boy, the whole bunch of them there they submitted today. So, yeah, that's where we're going to be. So we're growing, and apparently they like the content, especially since I broke away from the Headbangers Ball there, the ones that just, you know, let's see, we don't like Jews, we don't like Catholics, we don't like skin, we don't like this one, we don't like this color, we don't like purple, we don't like brown, we don't like, but yeah, we're going to unify, you know, but hey, you know, to each his own, that's what America's all about, you know, you get to believe whatever you want to believe, just don't hurt nobody else, and just don't offend anybody else, and it's common sense, common law, and that's what we're trying to get back to here, restoring our republic, restoring our Constitution, and getting back to the fundamentals of what our Constitution really stands for. And we know with these liberals out there, these Democrats, that it's going to be an impossibility. Now, I like some of the things, though, that have come out now recently, though, I must admit, you know, there's a couple issues here that I have supported, you know, as far as I'm not going to get into details here tonight, but I want to make sure I know what I'm talking about before I say it. I do support a Democratic policy, but, you know, some of the things that there was a couple things that I did. So I like the China thing. I mean, going against China. I mean, I know it doesn't address the intellectual property thing, but you know what? At least it's a step in the right direction. That's good. And, you know, if I was to ever run as a Democrat, of course, I would bring back the original Democrat, not the KKK part, but the original fundamental, the JFK type of thing. You know, John F. Kennedy, obviously, one of the greatest presidents, you know, obviously, of all time. I mean, definitely JFK. I mean, an important time and part in our history, and we know why they killed him. I mean, a man that should, I mean, imagine if they didn't assassinate him, what he could have accomplished, you know, in this country, how we would have gotten through the 60s, maybe a lot different than what we did, and how it would have carried over to the 70s. I mean, Nixon probably would have never got in there either. You know, so, you know, I mean, I liked Nixon, but, you know, hey, you know, Carter was the worst, though. Carter, Jimmy Carter, oh, Lord. But I'll tell you what, Carter, you know, he was a bad president, but you know what? The guy freaking, he did a lot for people, you know, building. I mean, that guy is, and he's still alive and kicking today. So, you know, the man's blessed, obviously. I mean, he did a lot for the people after he was president. But a terrible president in the United States, terrible. Just a terrible commander-in-chief. But, you know, let's analyze a president here. Now, I wanted to do the Money Masters. You know, I wanted to do the Money Masters about banking, but I've been doing presidents lately. So I got a short one here. It's not too long, but we got George Washington. So we'll do one on him, a biography on George Washington. The audio is good. That's why the Money Masters is a little messed up. So we'll see if I get any callers in tonight and want to have a discussion. If not, I'll do the Money Masters after this. It's about banking. I mean, I love that documentary. It explains what the problems we're in today about the financial situations and everything. But I'll see if I get the audio working on that pretty good. But we'll try the George Washington right now. So get that going.
The poet Robert Frost once remarked that George Washington was one of the few men in all of human history who was not carried away by power. Washington probably could have become king of America if he wanted to. There were those who thought he did. Instead, America's first general became the United States' first two-term sitting president, something a world familiar only with hereditary monarchs had never seen. Napoleon was nearly dying on St. Helena, condemned for having seized the power of an emperor, complained that his critics wanted me to be another Washington. Beneath the marble veneer of the figurehead, the man who has become namesake to thousands of young men, small towns, high schools, a nation's capital, and the 42nd state, whose image is reproduced endlessly on coins, currency, and stamps, whose portrait now hangs in nearly every museum and public building, in whose honor a towering white hobble was raised on the Capitol Mall, and a huge bust carved into a South Dakota mountain. We find a man seeking to belong, longing for acceptance and respect, hiding his insecurities behind a mask of aloofness, struggling with the sense of his own inadequacies. Rejected as a British officer at age 24, by age 42, the once loyal British subject had become Britain's arch enemy. Congress and never came to lead his nation's against all odds struggle for independence. Had he failed, he would have been hung as a traitor. In triumph, however, this dignified and self-possessed 6'2" son of Virginia became a great man. Perhaps the greatest man of his age. A man we still call the father of the country. Washington's Virginia was a world in which wealth, power, and family connections defined one's status. He inherited his. And yet through hard work, self-cultivation, a fortunate marriage, and a lifetime of public service, he lifted himself from the lesser rungs of Virginia society to its summit. Mason Locke Williams, an Episcopal clergyman and sometime bookseller, is the source of some of those often pious stories about George Washington, like chopping down his father's cherry tree, tossing coins across swollen rivers.
None of those are true. The cherry tree myth started in a biography that appeared after Washington's death by Parson Mason Weems, and very little is known about Washington's childhood, so he simply made up stories that illustrated the qualities that Washington exhibited as an adult, such as honesty. There's a very good source. Silver dollar myth. George Washington raised his wife's 2 grandchildren and 2 children, and the grandson near the end of his life wrote his memoirs in which he said that George Washington could throw a piece of slate the size and shape of a dollar across the river. The river he was referring to is the Rappahannock River, which near the site of the Washington homestead was about 250 feet across. The Potomac here at Mount Vernon is 1.25 miles, so that would have been some toss. But those are the 3 big myths, and it's interesting to talk about, but we'd like people to look beyond those myths and see the real George Washington.
The real George Washington was born in a modest farmhouse in Westmoreland County, Virginia, February 22, 1732, the first child of a middle-aged father's second wife. In the mid-18th century, Virginia was a province of the British Empire. Its sparse population of mostly English descent saw themselves as Englishmen, subjects of the king. But the British saw Virginians as cruel colonists, second class in every way. Within Virginia itself, at the peak of power were the families of the wealthy planters and others of much lesser wealth and property, which included George Washington. Washington spent his early years on small farms along the Potomac and Rappahannock. In sight of, but never totally within the embrace of, Virginia's well-born, well-heeled elite. His father, Augustine, died when he was 11. George inherited a farmhouse left in trust to his mother, Mary. But the bulk of Augustine Washington's estate, including a sizable plantation at Mount Vernon, went to his older half-brother, Lawrence. Unlike Lawrence, who had been educated in England, George's formal education ended when he was 14. To George, Lawrence represented everything he hoped to be. Cultivated, sophisticated, and rich. Lawrence became George's surrogate father, offering guidance and contact with the prominent Fairfax family into which Lawrence had married. The rough adolescent learned his social graces by quietly watching and imitating those in Lawrence's charmed circle. Acutely aware of his own lack of sophistication, fearful of social missteps, he developed lifelong habits of social reserve. Books on manners. He read English magazines and translations of Roman classics so that he would have something to say at dinner parties. But to become one of the elite, he needed to make money. By 17, he was working as a frontier surveyor in the Blue Ridge Mountains. At 18, he bought his first piece of land.
Washington, like all Virginians, land was the most valuable commodity in agrarian society. They needed land to replenish their tobacco fields, which wore out in 4 to 8 years. They needed land for speculative purposes, for a rainy day. It was the one form of inheritance they could pass on that would be of great value to their offspring.
During a trip to Barbados with Lawrence when he was 19, George contracted smallpox. It would scar his face for life, but it would also save him by immunizing him to the disease which would ravage his ragged American troops 25 years later. By the time Washington was 20, his carefully cultivated connection with the Fairfaxes led to an appointment as an officer of the Virginia Militia. As a new and inexperienced officer, it would not be long before Washington
Washington found himself embroiled in his first military campaign. A smoldering Cold War between England and France, fueled by conflicting land claims on two continents, hit a flashpoint in the Ohio Valley, just over the mountains from Virginia. In Europe, the conflict was called the Seven Years' War. In North America, it was known as the French and Indian Wars. As a 20-year-old major of the Virginia Militia, Washington's job was to train civilians for war. Unfortunately, he had neither the skills nor the knowledge he was expected to teach. But in typical 18th century fashion, he made up for his lack of practical experience by learning from books. The rest he was expected to make up as he went along. In the fall of 1753, England sent Washington, accompanied by two translators and four backwoodsmen, to warn the French off its territory. In his first mission as a British colonial officer, Washington managed to embarrass himself in an attempt at French-Indian negotiation, almost froze to death crossing an icy river, and was nearly murdered by his Indian guide. On his second foray into the field, ignoring the fact that England and France were not at war, Washington staged what he described as an Indian attack on a small French camp. One was the French diplomatic envoy. The French court granted him an assassin. Those Indian tribes still allied with the English, having witnessed the ineptitude of Washington's militia in action, promptly went over to the French. It was an inauspicious beginning.
Washington's attack on the French in western Pennsylvania, the battle in which he is alleged to have assassinated his opponent, was one of those early episodes where he walked onto the pages of history. Actually, he was criticized by the French, but in fact, people in Virginia defended him, people in England defended him, and indeed, the French commander himself had the authority to use force if necessary if the English or the Virginia militiamen confronted him. So Washington's probably taken something of a bad rap here.
The first real battle between the British and French was engaged at Fort Necessity near present-day Pittsburgh. Though eventually surrounded, and despite losing nearly one-third of his men, Washington fought on and refused to surrender. The French commander was the brother of the dead envoy. He finally called a ceasefire and allowed Washington's troops to go home. Washington signed a document legitimizing the French attack as revenge for the death of his envoy. Despite his less than stellar performance, Washington received no criticism from his superiors for his actions. Later, at the Battle of the Rift of Cain, he demonstrated what he liked in strategic war, for sheer bravery, when he had two horses shot from under him. 3 years later, again at Fort Duquesne, two groups of Virginia militiamen stumbled upon one another in the wilderness and mistakenly opened fire on each other. Washington rode between opposing lines, knocking away guns on both sides with his sword. 14 were killed, 26 were wounded. Washington wasn't touched. At age 24, he returned to the Tidewater, a hero to his fellow Virginians. But when he sought a commission as a full British officer, not just as a colonial officer, he was rudely rejected.
The young Washington, commanding a 350-mile line on the Virginia frontier with his so-called Virginia Regiment, thought of himself as anything but a partisan or a guerrilla. He wanted to build a regiment that was modeled after the British kind of unit. He insisted that his men be uniformed, that his officers read British drill manuals, and they received some wonderful compliments from British officers in the Forbes campaign who served with Washington's regiment. So he thought of himself as anything but a frontier soldier. He wanted to be a British officer, and indeed he wanted a British commission, but he never got one.
He resigned from the militia in protest, denied advancement in the British Army. He realized that if he was to make his mark in the world, he would have to do it as a civilian. Brother Lawrence had died in 1752. A few years later, George became the owner of Mount Vernon, which, though substantial, was nothing at all like the grand plantation it would eventually become. The house was a simple story and a half. There were few slaves and indentured workers to run the farm. Washington had lots of land but little money to work it with. And it was a loan. For 10 years, he had wooed a succession of young women, all of whom had rejected him. Some because he wasn't rich enough, and some because they were put off by his diffident personality. He had, however, fallen in love with the wife of George William Fairfax, his Mount Vernon neighbor,
his mentor, and one of Washington's few close friends. George had met Sally Fairfax when he was 16, and she 18. Sally was dark, witty, cutting, charming, a belle of the Tidewater, able to quote great philosophers and discuss the classics with governors and statesmen of the punch. Sally had taken it upon herself to groom the rough 16-year-old in the social graces, and he had fallen madly in love. He sent her love letters. She replied carefully, unwilling to risk her standing by becoming involved. Anything more than friendship with Sally was impossible.
Well, I know Sally Fairfax always comes into the act when George Washington is mentioned, and I think there's no doubt that he had a great affection for her. The whole context of the Fairfax family, the patrons of himself, helped in Washington's advancement, and his own childhood had been not as elegant. After all, the Washingtons were, shall we say, second-tier Tidewater aristocracy, where the Fairfaxes were first-tier aristocracy. And Washington, as a young man, was so impressed, and Sally was bright. She was well-educated, well-read. She was a gardener. They loved to talk about gardening. He mentions that in one of his letters. But it must be said that the Fairfaxes and the Washingtons were close friends. And during the time that they were together on adjoining estates, there was much visiting back and forth.
Still pining for Sally, George was introduced to Martha Custis, a 27-year-old widow and the mother of two. Martha Dandridge Custis was 5'2", with a pleasant appearance, was slightly plump, shy, serious, universally liked and easy to talk to. She was also one of the wealthiest marriageable women in all of Virginia. Her husband, Daniel Custis, had left her 17,000 acres of tobacco, hundreds of slaves, and several farms. While Martha managed the estate herself, she also understood the advantage of having an energetic partner. And while there were many things George Washington was not, he was energetic. The two had only spent 20-some hours together before George proposed marriage. Within a year, they were married, having spent only 15 days in one another's company. In marrying Martha Custis, Washington finally entered the world of the Virginia elite.
She was extremely supportive of him. She complimented him in many ways. She socialized more easily than Washington did, liked to talk with friends and greet them, whereas Washington was a little bit shy. And his size was intimidating. He used to frighten the children. But we're told that Mrs. Washington grabbed him by his lapels and pulled him right down to her face when she wanted to talk to him.
As tobacco prices fell, they saw their debts mounting. George and Martha faced a dilemma. Washington was fearful of going into debts, but equally fearful of what others might think when he was unable to maintain the side of life. If he economized, he said, such an alteration in the system might let people create suspicions of the decay in my fortune, and such a thought the world must not harbor. Image was all important to him. Washington saw his and his fellow planters' problem as one of dependence on their English agents, the men who sold Virginia's tobacco in Europe and who purchased finished goods on their behalf in London. Washington decided to stop growing labor-intensive, soil-depleting tobacco and grow grains instead. He was soon selling his produce in Alexandria and buying finished goods from local importers and American manufacturers instead of buying through the London agents. Within a decade, he was out of debt and a firm believer in American economic independence. And as the British Parliament levied one burdensome tax after another on the colonies, Washington began to see advantages in American political independence as well. Washington wrote to Brian Fairfax, Sally's brother in England, "I think the Parliament of Great Britain has no more right to put their hands in my pocket without my consent than I have to put my hand into yours for money." Soon, Washington joined Patrick Henry as one of the most influential members of the Virginia House of Burgesses. As relations between Britain and the colonies deteriorated, Virginia sent Washington as one of its representatives to the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia. By the time the Second Continental Congress convened 1 year later, fighting had broken out between the Massachusetts men and the British regulars. To symbolize the
his commitment to the cause of resistance. Washington arrived in Philadelphia wearing his military uniform. John Adams nominated George Washington as Commander-in-Chief of the Army, which would wage the war for national independence. His election was unanimous. Washington was actually a very good choice to command the American Army. He had commanded a significant portion of men in the French and Indian War. He had as much experience in that war, good experience, as any American, probably better. He had served in the Virginia legislature after that for 17 years, so he knew the legislative mind, and throughout the war he had to deal with Congress, a legislative body. And in fact, military theory and doctrine had changed very little in the 17 years since he had taken off his uniform and then put it on again in 1775. Today, an officer would be technologically behind after 2 or 3 years out of the line. But the 18th century, very little was changing in terms of theory and practice.
Washington accepted the assignment knowing that if he failed, he would lose everything he had struggled so hard to gain. He would lose Mount Vernon. He would be arrested and hung as a traitor. There was no turning back. During the 8-year War of Independence, the troops of Washington's Continental Army were chronically underfed, underdressed, and supplied. The tales of barefoot soldiers leaving bloody footprints in the snow were not fiction. The hardships of Valley Forge in the winter of 1779 were not exaggerations. Once the makeshift cabins were built, the men were finally out of the freezing wind and blowing snow. But each sentry still had to borrow clothes from his bunkmates for his turn with the guard. As the guard rotated, so did the clothing. Deeply feeling the plight of his men, Washington constantly hounded the Continental Congress for supplies, trying to shame them by appealing to their sense of patriotism.
Obviously, there were tensions during the war between the Congress and the Army, because Congress was weak. It had little power. It could do really very little to meet the Army's material needs. But Washington tried to inform the officers and enlisted men of the liabilities that Congress labored under. So Washington was really a kind of diplomat in a coalition war. He kind of held things together between a weak Congress and 13 independent states, and an army that was often disgruntled, and with good reason.
Congress's typical response was to give Washington permission to commandeer what he needed from those living near his bivouacked army. Washington refused this invitation to rob his fellow citizens at the point of the bayonet, arguing that to do so alienated the very people in whose name the struggle had been undertaken. To fill his ranks, Washington turned slowly to the idea of desegregating his troops, urging that slaves be offered their freedoms in return for service. He urged cooperation. As rebels, he said, quoting Ben Franklin, "Either we hang together, or we hang separately." In the heat of battle, Washington was brilliant and courageous to a fault. Throughout his military career, Washington seemed in charge. On horseback, he led charges into the thick of battle, brutally exposing his own cannon and muscle fire. When General Cornwallis asked for the terms, Washington replied that the same honor should be granted to the surrendering army as were granted to the garrison of Charleston. The point was not lost on Cornwallis. When Charleston fell to the British in 1780, the British had refused to grant the Americans the honors of war, treating them as rebels, not as a legitimate enemy. Washington now demanded the same humiliation of Cornwallis. But Cornwallis claimed illness and set a stand-in to the surrender ceremony. In an attempted insult, the British stand-in tried to hand over Cornwallis' sword to a French officer who had fought with the Americans. But the Frenchman refused, directing him instead to General Washington. Washington also refused. He ordered the Englishman to surrender Cornwallis' sword to General Lincoln, who had been the American commander of the Charleston garrison. By 18th century standards, he was an uninspired commander. The Washington studied and conducted himself as a European-style commander. He never claimed to be more than he was. He saw himself as a citizen soldier, obliged to serve his countrymen in their time of need, answering the call of duty.
It's true that it's a fighter. Some of Washington referred to him as a Fabian, as one who would not confront the enemy. But if you look at the record, he was actually a fighting general. On two or three occasions, he wanted to assault the British in Boston in the winter of 1775, 1776. He stayed in New York and fought the British in 1776 when being on Manhattan Island was really precarious. Then he scored the little twin miracles at Trenton and Princeton, two aggressive encounters in the wintertime. He attacked the British rear guard at Monmouth. He was actually a fighting general. Now, it's true he didn't win many battles, but the Americans generally didn't win many big battles.
During his campaign against the British, Washington was always outnumbered, typically outgunned, and always short on supplies, weapons, wagons, horses, and boats. Yet he repeatedly slipped the British noose, choosing strategic retreat, honorable defeat. He doggedly wore his enemy down. The British lost the war, not so much because the Americans under Washington defeated them in battle, but because General George Washington would not give up or go away.
He wore the enemy down. He was persistent. He stayed with them. This was to a degree a war of attrition, and in this sense, the Americans had the advantage in that England was fighting 3,000 miles away from home in a period when there was not instantaneous communication or transportation. So in a sense, he knew what he was doing in wearing them down. Even his British victories were really Pyrrhic victories in almost every case. You think about the number of men they lost, irreplaceable men.
Washington was the unanimous choice of the delegates to preside over the Constitutional Convention of 1787. By choice and custom, as president of the Assembly, he rarely spoke during its sessions. As the delegates debated the nature of a constitutional presidency, it was a foregone conclusion that Washington would be the natural choice to fill the office, whatever form it took. Since the best 18th century example of a stable government responsive to the people was the constitutional monarchy, there were those who thought Washington should become king of America. Others thought a new, titled American aristocracy should be created. Washington angrily opposed both notions. As the 55 delegates shaped their image of the presidency, they had before them day after day the image of George Washington on the dais, presiding over debate. Had anyone else been in that seat, the United States might well have had a cabinet government or a three-person executive appointed by the legislature. The choice of America's first electoral college was unanimous. Without seeking the position, George Washington, at age 57, had been chosen to lead his new nation as the first president of the United States. His journey north from his beloved Mount Vernon for the inauguration turned into a spontaneous, triumphal march for the whole nation. Aware of the need to add grace and dignity to the new government, Washington indulged in such pomp as he felt appropriate for a citizen. His critics suspected one argument.
Washington was absolutely comfortable staying within the framework of the Anglo-American tradition of civil control of the military. Now, it is true there were some Americans, probably just a handful really, who felt that all the adulation that Washington received was unhealthy, that he might be tempted to exceed the bounds of propriety, to become a kind of Caesar, in other words. Washington, in one way, was like other famous revolutionaries, successful revolutionaries in modern history. Certainly different in that he had a healthy psyche. He didn't have a narcissus complex. He was no threat to the revolution. And because he was no threat, our revolutionary leaders died in their beds, and that was one of the remarkable things about our revolution.
Such was the sensitivity to this monarchical issue that it provoked a raging debate in the first days of the first Congress. A full week was spent trying to decide how the chief executive of their new government would be addressed. Among the proposals were His Highness, His Excellency, Mouth-bending His Highness the President of the United States and Protector of the State, His Mightiness, His Most Benign Highness, and His Elective Highness. They finally decided to refer to him simply as the President of the United States. Familiar has been how all are with Washington's face on our stamps and money. Another vigorous debate broke out in the legislature when it was proposed to place Washington's profile on the newly minted coins. Many that smacked of Caesarism, dictatorship, loyalty. In his place, a symbolic female liberty was embossed on the little coins.
His face would not appear on the dollar bill until the middle of the next century.
Slightly buxom, slightly plump, was highly desirable.
in the 18th century. Now, you add to that, of course, the fact of her great wealth, which everybody knows. She was a very pleasant woman. Everybody who knew her over a 20-year period consistently talked about what a healthy psyche she had, what a nice person she was, what a good listener she was. I think it was probably a wonderful marriage.
You know, to those people who would say that maybe George didn't really love Martha very much, he invited her to spend every winter of the war with him. And if a man ever had an opportunity to stay away from his wife, that was it. And he simply did not take advantage of it. He loved her.
With the endless rounds of parties, receptions, late dinners at which the new president was the guest of honor, and which protocol usually forbade Martha from attending,
corresponded with those who continue the struggle of keeping the British barren on course and free of the dangerous storms consuming Europe. Then the French Revolution reached ever more fatal and bloodier peaks, and he took time to attend to his personal life.
I think there was no doubt that Mount Vernon was a magnet for George Washington. Wherever he was thinking about it, he was talking about it, he was corresponding about it. It is what sustained him during the Revolution. Through all of those trying times, he sat down once a week and wrote to his manager and maintained a very strong tie with the place that he loved best. It really meant everything to him. It had been in the family since the 17th century and really was a man home. And he developed it from the original 2,500 acres that the family owned to 8,000 contiguous acres.
After not seeing her for over 25 years, both Martha and George wrote letters of heartfelt friendship to Sally Fairfax. Now widowed, years. Sally had been living in England since 1773. Wrote Washington, "My dear madam, 25 years nearly have passed away since I have considered myself as the permanent resident of this place. During this period, so many important events have occurred and such changes in things have taken place. The compass of a letter will give you but an inadequate idea of none of which events, however, nor all of them together, to eradicate from my mind the recollection of those happy moments, the happiest in my life, which I have enjoyed in your company." He went on to wistfully suggest that Sally return to the land of her birth. Sally Fairfax never came back to the country her old friend had helped bring into existence. But in Washington's letter to her, he also wrote of the magnificent new city being built on the banks of the Potomac, a city which would become his nation's new capital. On December 12, 1799, Washington took his usual tour of Mount Vernon on horseback, riding 5 hours in hail, snow, and rain. The next day, he stayed home, nursing a sore throat. By nightfall, he couldn't speak. The doctor was sent for. His condition began to deteriorate. He called for his secretary, Tobias Lear, and the prophet asked that he not be buried too quickly. He wanted to make sure that he wouldn't be buried alive. But ever conscious of decorum and dignity, he also did not want his funeral to turn into a spectacle. Lear promised that his wishes would be honored. Washington drew him closer and repeated his instructions to make absolutely certain that Lear had understood him. He had. Washington said, "'Tis well," closed his eyes, and died. When George Washington died at the age of 67, his friend and comrade-at-arms, Light Horse Lee, eulogized him with the now familiar words, "First in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen." Never considered a great thinker or strategist, Washington's genius was leadership. Once set on a course of action, he pursued it to its end. He persevered. Patient, self-possessed, often cold and distant to others, he appealed to men's better angels, inspiring others to reach beyond their personal limitations and seize greatness. He understood power and used it wisely. There are those who praise Washington as America's only true, nonpartisan, and innately virtuous president. He risked everything to command an army of revolution. Facing the world's greatest military power, he managed to keep his ill-equipped, poorly trained, undermanned army in the field to lead it. He avoided defeat, and thereby won the war. He left his stamp on the institution of the presidency, which in so many ways he invented. He steered the new nation through its first troubled decade. Possible for the fledgling United States to mature without becoming embroiled in any foreign wars. The path of George Washington's life was one from frontier to capital, from periphery to center, and of all those who helped create the new nation.
can't say that about any president. Can't say that about Joe Biden, can you? Wonder what the documentary will say about him 100 years from now, if we make it that far. But anyway, Blog Talk Radio, understand the times in which we live today. Late night show. Ah, West Coast. Yeah. All right. Yeah, mask-free America. There you go. All right, well, not in today's day and age. You're a slave. You obey. You obey. That's it. You'll be arrested. But anyway, that was George Washington, documentary there on George Washington. Last night, if you missed last night, we did Andrew Jackson. That was and it's an important time to bring this type of information out there, because they're trying to strangle us and take away the truth by tipping down statues, burning down our cities, burning down Dollar Trees, of course, BLM there. And, if you have a school that's named George Washington University or something like that, Washington University, we've got to change the name, right? That is racist. That's prejudiced, and that's racist. And that's what we get, right? Jefferson, racist. Adams, racist. So any schools, anything that's in the history books, they're getting rid of. They're eliminating it right now as we speak. This summertime right now, they're getting ready for the next school year coming up. And I bet you, if you were to check your local school or county or in the curriculum that they have planned for next year or the year after, they are gearing it up for what? Your critical race theory, right? And people are speaking out against it, but it's not getting any traction, really, because they're going to teach it to your kids. They're going to teach it. I played something there last night about it, about 5-year-olds learning about sex, learning about sex. You know, these teachers, these schools. And these schools really run you. Listen, I got a son that's in school. He's in public school. And, hey, I got to prove who I am before I can find out anything about him when he goes to that school, because once they got him, they're in his custody, right? They're in his that they will guard him and they will protect him, right? Not because, you know, the fact of the matter is that I would say pull your kids out of the public school system. Get them out. Get them out, because you don't want them in there. You don't want them in there listening to that crap. I mean, they're not going to learn the truth. They're not going to learn anything that's going to help them later on in life. I mean, they're doing away with, in California, they're doing away with math, doing away with English. I mean, look this stuff up. I'm not making this stuff. You can't make this stuff up. Look it up. So if you got children that are in public schools, I say get them the hell out, homeschool them. I mean, what did they do back then in 1776? I mean, those guys, we're talking about founding fathers. Do you think their kids, I mean, listen to how he learned, how he was well-read. And, you know, I understand we don't grow up on the farm anymore, but we should be even more smarter, because we don't do anything all day, but we'll stare at our phones and stare at the Internet. We should be looking at information. So anyway, 657-383-0616, press number 1. All right, I already got somebody here who wants to jump in here. Go ahead, 770. I'll take callers here tonight. Yeah, go ahead.
Joe, I cannot tell you how glad I am to hear you devote a show to the greatest American in the history of the United States, the man most indispensable to its founding and to have it created as it was, the closest thing to a political god this country has ever or ever will have, George Washington. Man,
yep.
you ought to be complimented for that. You cannot understand the United States without understanding absolutely how indispensable that man was to this republic.
Yeah.
Utterly
indispensable. Obviously, he was blessed and protected, obviously, because, I mean, the guy was defeated so many times on the battlefield. And look at the history of him, you know. And at the end, what did he say? He was humble. Humble. How can you not respect that? Humble. He didn't want nobody saying, hey, what a great guy you were. What a great president. What a king you were. He didn't want it. He wanted to give it to you, the people.
But, Joe, it is so much more than that. I mean, to understand George Washington, you really got to go into the depth of his history and what he did. And when you do, you will realize what an amazing man this guy was. Just amazing. He didn't have that great a formal education, although he was sort of a contemporary aristocrat. But he never really was a man of formal learning or great intellect like, say, Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin. But the one thing he had, you know, and I'm going to say it right now, he was the greatest president this country has ever had and the greatest single American this country has ever had. What he had more than anything else, what he had in abundance, was leadership ability, and character. He had that,
yeah.
And without it, we would not have had a United States. In fact,
and humility.
A lot of people
he had humility, too, though. He had humility. He had humility.
Well, yes,
you know?
He did. And here's how he expressed it. His generals, first of all, when there was a lot of discontent with the Continental Congress, when after the victory at Yorktown and while the Treaty of Paris was being negotiated, you had the Continental Army in its headquarters in Newburgh, New York. And they were there. And there were rumors going around that his officers were very discontented with the horrid treatment they'd gotten from Congress. They hadn't been paid. Most of the soldiers hadn't been paid. None of the promises that the Continental Congress had made to the Army, almost none of them had been fulfilled. And George Washington knew he was dealing with a near mutiny in his ranks. And so the officers actually plotting to overthrow the Continental Congress and install him as the king. When George Washington got wind of this, what he did was something that was so extraordinary that every American should understand when you are devoted to an idea and you have character, this is the kind of thing you do. He went before his officers, you know, and he gave them a heartfelt speech. And this is what he said. And I'm quoting, this is a quote from what the guy said. He said, "If my conduct heretofore has not evinced to you that I have been a faithful friend to the Army, my declaration of it at this time would be equally unavailing and improper. But as I was among the first who embarked in the cause of our common country, as I have never left your side one moment, but when called from you on public duty, as I have been the constant companion and witness of your distresses, and not among the last to feel and acknowledge your merits, it can scarcely be supposed at this late stage of the war that I am indifferent to your interests." And then when he was reassuring his men of congressional good faith, he started to read aloud a letter from Congressman Joseph Jones of Virginia, and he tripped over the first sentence because he couldn't read the words. He had a lot of eye strain from reading literally thousands of documents during the war, and he had gotten a pair of new glasses. And so he pulled out his spectacles, and this shocked his officers. They'd never seen him wear glasses before. And then he said this. And this is one of the great moments in American history that is often unremarked. This is one of the greatest moments in American history right here. "Gentlemen, you must pardon me. I have grown gray in your service and now find myself going blind." And these words had such an influence on his men, many of them started to cry and tear up. Because he was only 51 years old, but he was much more haggard than the young planter who had taken charge of the Army in 1775. Just putting on his glasses moved his officers so much as they recalled all of the sacrifices he'd made for his country. And when he left the hall, the mutiny had ended, and his victory in the Revolution was complete. And people like Thomas Jefferson said, only someone like George Washington could have made the victory of the Revolution so complete and not allow its ideals to be betrayed after it had been fought for and won. And everybody at the time acknowledged George Washington as somewhat of almost a secular god. And we think rock stars are big today. We have no idea of what George Washington meant.
That's what I'm saying. Sorry, that's a great point. That's a great point. You don't see people walking around with a George Washington shirt. I mean, I'm not trying to take away from anything else, but I'm trying to say is that everyone has these idols today that there are these role models. They wear football jerseys and whatnot. You know, where's the George Washington jersey at? You know, where is that? You know, I mean, this guy he was a racist. He was this. You know, the media tears him apart, and it's terrible. It's terrible. I mean, this guy was a hero.
Look, you got to remember among the things responsible for his appeal. First of all, he'd be tall even today. He's 6 feet four.
Yeah.
But in that time, he was like a giant. He was muscular, well-built. He had a lifetime of working hard as a surveyor when he was young. He was a great horseman and a great dancer. And all of these things people admired. Women admired him because he was graceful and despite his size and his strength.
Yeah.
And, even though he didn't have the greatest of military achievements like Alexander or Caesar or Cromwell or Marlborough, and nothing, of course, to what Napoleon would eventually come to get. And by the way, you know what Napoleon said about him? Napoleon said about him when they asked him why didn't he resign, his office after being ousted as emperor. He said, "What do you expect me to be? Do you expect me to become George Washington?" And the fact that he resigned his commission was another one of the great things he did for the country. No other general at that sort of power had ever voluntarily resigned his office and then go back to being a farmer. He was like the Roman Cincinnatus, who had accomplished a great victory for the Republic and then hung up his armor and a sword and went back to farm. And that's what George Washington did. He gave up all his offices and went back to farm.
Yeah.
He didn't, he didn't want to be king. He didn't want to be Cromwell. Yeah. See, this sets
what,
the stage
Matt,
the
compare
Republic.
Him to today. Compare him to today. Oh, my Lord. There would be no, even, you know, as much as you love Trump or whatever, or Reagan or Kennedy even. I mean, well, yeah, I love Kennedy. I mean, he was assassinated, so we can't say him because that's not fair to him. But all the other ones, you know, all the ones, you know, he was the greatest president of all time, the first president. And
he was
and,
the best American
you know, he founded
of all
this country. Yeah.
He was the greatest American of all time, period.
Yeah,
end of
American.
Story.
There you
in
go.
In fact,
yeah.
He is the only American out of all the great Americans we have. And let's face it, we could have a great holiday for every great American that has ever lived and have plenty of room for more if there were more than 365 days in a year. But if you're going to pick one American to have a holiday, because there's only 365 days in a year, and we know we've had more than 365 Americans who are probably worthy of a holiday. The one figure you should pick should be George Washington. To a day only to himself. That is the one American who should have it head and shoulders above all the others, because that's what he was, head and shoulders over all of the others. I mean,
we can learn from
despite losing and losing and losing and losing in battle after battle after battle. His ability to hold his army together after it was getting beaten over and over again. The way he kept fighting Congress for the needed supplies for his men when they were suffering through the ordeal of Valley Forge. And his personal courage in combat, leading from the front. I mean, all these things are the hallmarks of a great, great leader, and he had them in abundance. And this country was truly blessed to have that man at that particular time.
Yeah.
Truly.
It was.
He was more than any other single American. He was indispensable to the revolution.
Yeah, without
and
him, oh, yeah.
And the form that the presidency took. They wanted to put all these fancy titles on the presidency, like Your Excellency, Garter of all of our liberties and all stuff, kind of like Adolf Hitler, Das Grossenfeldenherr, Das Alles Zeitung,
yeah,
something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Now, he didn't want none of that. What he said, finally, he was relieved when Congress agreed the title should be simply Mr. President. He thought that was appropriate for the Republic.
That's right.
That's a great
man.
And
you got to compare him. You just made a good comparison right there. You know what? That man right there, none of those men back then would ever committing suicide or going all that. You know what? They'd stand there and say, hey, they'd fight to the death. I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees. You know? I mean, that was what brought this country to, and like you said, everyone says about the past, and they brought the slave thing. I'm glad they brought that up, actually, because he was against slavery. You know, he was against it, but what could he do? It was like hey, look, you guys remain here, be free. You know, I can't take you back here. You know, just be quiet. You know what I mean? That's how he was. You know, I mean, you know, just
well,
don't
well,
say nothing.
Well,
you know,
I've
don't worry
done
about
a lot
it.
Of studying on Washington and the issue of slavery. And it is definitely a much more nuanced people than these morons and these historical illiterates who want nothing more than to denigrate the man because he is so crucial to the founding of this republic. And everything that has to do with the founding of this republic, they seek to deconstruct. So they're a bunch of liars and deconstructionists, and that's the only reason they criticize in the way they do. But if you study the issue, you will know it is much more nuanced than that. And I'll tell you why. Here's why. Because he was the only major founder out of all of them who actually ended up freeing a slave. Now, he knew it was wrong. He knew it was inconsistent with the ideals of the revolution. He said he understood, you know, when he grew up in the country he grew up in, There were many degrees of inequality and freedom, that's even among white people. Slavery just seemed to be the most base and degraded status in a hierarchy of inequality and dependency. Now, we got these modern sensibilities that are so arrogant that we just can't imagine people living in a different time in a different set of circumstances. But slavery was a worldwide institution. It existed for thousands of years without substantial criticism. And after all, this was still early 18th century America when he came into life, when he came into birth. Now, it was it was literally accepted worldwide.
Worldwide, you made a key point right there. Worldwide,
that did not have slavery, none, and that certainly includes the American colonies. But when he became commander in chief, military circumstances at first, admittedly, caused him to change his original view that black people shouldn't be soldiers. He advocated the recruitment of blacks in the Continental Army, which was integrated, by the way. He allowed in 1788 Rhode Islanders to raise an all-black regiment of soldiers. He approved a plan to grant slaves their freedom in return for military service, which the Congress shot down, but he did approve it. And he did understand the fears and prejudices of his fellow Southern plantation slave owners. And he wasn't surprised when that plan failed. But still, he led a racially integrated army that consisted of as 5,000 black soldiers in the Continental Army. That's not counting the militia. And that is a substantial portion of the whole army, which is what, something like 120,000 people? So 5,000 is a pretty substantial percentage.
Yeah.
And then by the time he came back to Mount Vernon at the end of the war, he's believed slavery should be abolished, not simply because it was an inefficient labor system, which was certainly every enlightened person was beginning to understand, but, he just knew it was wrong. He privately vowed in 1786 he wouldn't purchase any more slaves. He had 200 at that time, half of whom were too young or too old to work because he wouldn't sell them off. He thought he was obligated to care for them. And he told his fellow Virginian that he hoped slavery could be eliminated by slow, sure, and imperceptible degrees because he knew any other plan would be politically impossible. Now, he wanted to free his slaves because he said, and this is what he said publicly again, when he contemplated retiring from the presidency, he was freeing what he called, and it's a quote, a certain species of property which I possess very repugnantly to my own feelings. But there were problems with that. Not only was it difficult to translate his land holdings into cash, but he felt that a majority of his slaves, who now were close to 300, didn't belong to him, but they were dower slaves who belonged to Martha and her heirs. So he couldn't just
leave them behind in Pennsylvania. He left them behind in Pennsylvania to because once in Pennsylvania, only a certain amount of time, then you become a free person. And he also kept the families together. That's key right there. You know what that shows? When someone keeps a family together, that shows the character of an individual because family is important. Family is an important aspect.
Yeah, look what he did in his will, when he wrote his will. It's one of the most important documents he ever wrote because he and his Martha slaves had intermarried. And he said that only upon the death of his wife would all his slaves be free, so the ones that had married could stay together. And he didn't just throw them out into the world. He not only did he forbid any of the slaves from being transported out of Virginia under any pretense whatsoever, but he directed all of the freed slaves who were too young or too old to be independent should be supported for as long as necessary. That was in his will. Not only were the young to be cared for until they were 25 years of age, but they were to be taught to read and write and be prepared for some useful occupation. That's in the will. And knowing how his family felt, not to mention a larger world of Virginia, he loaded his will with a bunch of written imperatives, like most pointedly and most solemnly enjoining his executors religiously to fulfill his commands without evasion, neglect, or delay.
Yeah.
One of the most important things the guy did in his life, the one that made him internationally famous and admired, frankly, because nobody could imagine doing this, when he resigned as commander-in-chief of the American Armed Forces. That act, together with his letter to the states where he promised his retirement, was what he called his legacy to his country. No American leader has ever left a more important legacy. None.
Yeah.
Because
right.
We just don't understand the times in which he grew up in. See, we're looking at this with the benefit of 2021 hindsight.
Yeah, I know.
He lived in the 18th century. It was a different world, and people didn't look at these things like we look at them now.
No, and they were brutal.
Groundbreaking what he did.
Man, a wife wasn't able to leave her husband back then. I mean, you could be stoned, for goodness sake.
A victorious general surrendering his arms and returning to his farm was unprecedented in modern times. Like I said, there was Cincinnatus in the Roman Republic, but nobody ever done anything like that. There were Cromwell, William of Orange, Marlborough. All of them sought political rewards that were commensurate with what they achieved. You know, and even though people said, hey, Washington, he could become a king, he could become a dictator, he didn't want nothing to do with it. He was sincere in his desire for all of his soldiers, and it's a quote from the guy, quote, to return to our private stations in the bosom of a very free, peaceful, and happy country.
Right.
And
who do you like
King
better?
King George III, whom he defeated, predicted that if Washington retired from public life and returned to his farm, quote, he will be the greatest man in the world. Jefferson said that the moderation and virtue of a single character probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been, by a subversion of that liberty it was intended to establish. Washington was simply the greatest American that ever lived. And I wish to God people would remember him for that, because there's no doubt, without him, I'm going to say it flat out, there would not have been a United States. Certainly not the way it is today. Well, in the form of a republic, there definitely wouldn't have been.
That's right. And the ideas, the ideals that they spread forward. You got to remember, you said it very clearly, they lived in a specific time, but their ideas they knew, they foresaw in the future would mold the country. And they even foresaw a civil war happening, because you mentioned it about the South and the North. They saw these things happening, but they gave us ways out, and they said the people will have to decide. You know, just like I said, what did you give us? We gave you a republic if you can keep it. You know, that these are famous quotes that are written down throughout history. You know, and that's the thing, and that's why it's so important. That's why I'm playing these, is because we have this narrative coming from the corporate news media that this is bad, and I'm trying to put it out there that, hey, let's hear the story, because it's all researchable. You could find, you got the internet at your fingertips. Look the stuff up. You can find it, and you can go to the Library of Congress, look up actual handwritten letters of these men, you know, that exist today, that you could read their thoughts, their personal thoughts, their correspondences, you know, like that one with the woman there, Fairfax. That was interesting, because you know what? He had a respect for her, and, you know, he liked her, he wanted her, but he had a respect. You know what I mean? And that you don't have that today between men and women. You know, and there's no respect. You know, and that's so important. That's a key aspect that you get back to those values. And it doesn't matter how many different peoples we have in this country. They call it, say, the great melting pot or whatever. And that's what I'm saying, division, dividing. And I went over this last night with the globalist agenda, how to their new world order plan and how they're going to conquer us. Stop with the petty arguments between the people. You know, this guy, this group, that group. Even the border crisis, secure the border. You know, but the people, you know, but, you know, or with attacking Asians, or like we discussed about the NSM platform there, which, you know, you can't be attacking one group of people. You can believe whatever way you want to believe. You can feel whatever you want to feel. But the fact of the matter is that we all have a right. We have a human right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And this country is the only country that has the foundation that we can stand upon to spread those wings. And if we lose this country, if we lose this republic, the rest of the world's going to hate us, number one. They're already looking down on us saying, what the hell are you doing over there? And I'll tell you right now, without us, like Ronald Reagan said, we'll go and plunge into 1,000 years of darkness. We are in trouble without America. The world is. You know, world peace, it's on our shoulders. And the thing, I know we're not going to see that, but I'm just saying, the freedom, the idea of freedom, and the founders, George Washington, like you said, the greatest American that ever lived, if we could live by example or try to emulate his what he did and how he lived, imagine how much better we'd be as a people amongst ourselves, you know?
Look, I'm going to tell you something, man. I'm going to tell you something, you know? We look at George Washington like he came from another world, you know? And looking at him in the 21st century, he seems so removed from us, has to be almost incomprehensible, like he came from another time, another place, even another world. And that's the whole point. He did come from another world. And his countrymen knew it almost before he died in 1799. He was the only truly classical hero this country has ever had. He was admired as a classical hero in his own lifetime. Among the people, his contemporaries, as Americans at the time.
I got another caller on the line, Sarge. But yeah, I just want to let you know I got another caller. Finish your point. Oh, you want me to bring him on?
But among the fellow Americans that he had, the only person who rivaled him in acclaim was Benjamin Franklin, and that was only in science and philosophy. Washington was one of Plutarch's men, like, you know, that saying goes, the defenders of an ideal. And like Adams, like John Adams, he became like an anachronism, I guess you could say. He was like the pre-democratic and pre-egalitarian world from the 18th century, different from everything that followed it. That's why he seems so remote to us. He belongs to a world we have lost and one they were losing even when he was alive.
Yeah.
But yet and still,
he still
was able to carry this new ideal forward as its most important and greatest champion. That man was a great man, period, end of story. You could look at his flaws, great, every human being's got them, but his virtues were so great as to make his flaws seem like almost nothing.
Right. And you know, I play that sometimes, too, the Adams speech there. You know, give me a republic, you know, a country of laws, not men. You know, but, you know, 918, I'll bring you on. Go ahead.
Hi. It sounds like it's Sarge's show, Mr. Gibson. You know, one thing Washington could not do was swim. He was almost drowned by the Menominee Indians in the French-Indian War.
Really?
You know,
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. Or was, almost.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, that was a time when a French Indian chief, noticing all the bullets that were passing through his coat and not killing him at the Battle of Monongahela, said that man is destined to become a great prince of a country and lead the country to a great victory. I forget the chief's name, but he predicted accurately Washington's ascension to leadership.
Well,
he
left at
him and saw him rallying his men and just braving the fire without any regard for his own safety. And he said, this is going to be a great captain. He was trying to kill him.
He was almost drowned at this French-Indian battle, with the French-Indian War. And they laughed about how he couldn't swim.
Was he an escort? How did that go? I mean, how did this French Indian come in contact with him? What was that about?
He was one of
the Menominee Indians.
Sarge, hang on. I was asking 918 real quick because she brought it up, so I was just wondering. Go ahead.
It was a surprise attack by the Menominee tribe, and they went into the water, some of them, with the horses, and that's where he was almost drowned.
Okay, all right. I didn't know that, actually. I just played a whole thing on George Washington, a whole thing about a special on about 45 minutes, you know, where it went from his youth all the way up until his death. I just played that, actually, a documentary about him. So that's why we're talking about it, actually. So in case you missed it.
I have a couple good autobiographies, and it's part of Menominee folklore, too. They talk about it, and then it's written about in the battles or surprise skirmishes during the French Indian War.
Yeah, I got you on the phone, if you don't mind. Let me ask you a question. What do you think about today and how the foundations of the founders, how they're so ridiculous? I mean, they're tearing down statues, names of schools. I mean, the news media is just, you know, George Washington, they make fun of him, wooden teeth, you know, mock him. He was a slave owner, so he was a racist, you know, stuff like that. I mean, what's your opinion on that? I mean, how do we reverse this
trend
that's going on?
Well, in Europe, race is not an issue. in Europe, race, well, maybe in the last 15 years, where, like in France, they're very anti-Muslim. And, but when I think about Black Lives Matter and part of the factions may have gone very extreme, but why should we glorify a slave owner? Why should we? Should we? I think
well, who
that's
was a
the question.
Yeah, who, yeah, okay. So as far as George Washington and his time period and the founding their time period, wasn't the entire globe and the planet at that time slave owners? Basically, slavery was an accepted type of act and practice during those time periods, even though it was wrong. But back then, it was deemed right.
I've gone to museums, like one that has a Native American woman, and it has the nameplate of squaw. You know, and that was a term, a very derogatory term, back in its time frame. Why do we still have to use it? Do we still have to use the N-word? Should there be a statue of an African-American man with the N-word on it?
No, there shouldn't. But do you want to change the meaning of the word
why
just
the
because
others?
It offends people?
Well,
why the other? Well, the other was part of history.
It disenfranchises.
Who decides what truth is? Well, hang on. Let me ask you this question. Who decides then what true? What history is true and what is not? I mean, facts are facts and truth is not relevant, right?
But labels limit. And when you put like the N-word on a statue or the squaw word on a statue, it limits the representation of that person.
Yeah, but we don't have any statues with N-words on.
Yeah,
so
I mean, that's
like
just,
a hypothetical,
it is.
Right?
No, that's not a hypothetical. There is a statue of a Native American woman, and it does have the word squaw underneath it. And I doubt there's any statues with the N-word on it, but maybe there is. I don't know every museum.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, it was a sign of the times. But there's no explanation of what that word was, how it dehumanized Native American women. Yeah, there's nothing there to explain other than Native American woman statue and then the word squaw underneath it. But I think that's very limiting.
And
I've gone
then,
there like every other 10 years, and it's still there.
But if we take it away, right, and we say, hey, this is how people were back then, and this is how they dehumanized women back then, if we erase that part of our history, then you know what? We teach our youth never to learn that it was a mistake or that's what people did, and then we may make the era, generations from now, of repeating history. So we have to learn from history.
Well,
that's how I would view it.
I would reply back that there's nothing to explain how the word squaw was used initially. It means vagina, by the way. Squaw means vagina. Schultz means penis. It's very derogatory. And there was no plaque, nothing, no sign, no audio thing where you can scan a smart code and find out the history of that word. So I mean, there's museums that do that, and I think those type of representations need to be corrected.
Well, you see, but is it a private museum? Yeah, you get into the fact, well, is it a private museum or is it a publicly funded museum? Is it a museum that's supposed
publicly
to teach
funded.
What? Publicly funded. Okay, well, if it's publicly funded, then that would be up to the people then to decide, I guess, if it should be removed. But again, I just very careful about erasing history as it was foreseen at that time period. Even if it's wrong, dehumanizing, or violent, or, you know, whatever it may be, I think if it happened, we need to see it. And then what we do is we don't let anyone else tell us how to believe or perceive it. We take our own conscience and from our own moral standing and from what we know as educated people today and make a character judgment or a fundamental judgment based upon our own beliefs as individuals. Mm-hmm. And you know what? If the majority disagrees with us, then so be it. If the minority disagrees, so be it. As long as I'm not hurting you or the next person or the squaw or whatever, you know, that it shouldn't matter today, right? Because we know better.
I think this is definitely a Native American statue. The population that it represents should have a voice. they should be able to tell their stories their way. I went to the Greenwood Film Festival, which was an African-American film festival, for the last couple of days. It was enlightening, very enlightening. They need to tell their own stories their way. Not because white people.
Well, you're right. Mr. Gibson, are you a white person?
Would you consider yourself white or Caucasian?
Yes. I have my skin. Well, I'm actually brown because I stay out in the sun all the time because I'm tan. So I actually, but I'm a landscaper.
But my point in asking that.
Yep.
Is that it's hard for I'm a white person too, and there was a time that it was hard for me to see outside of my race. You know, just in the system I was brought up in, the school system, the church, you know, the whole thing. And I think once we can see outside of our race, maybe we can see things differently and work with people differently.
Yeah, well,
but you see, you came out okay, obviously.
With looking at things outside of my race. I was taught all along that the only thing I needed to know was the grievances of my people's race. I was taught to focus and obsess and fetishize my grievances against my country. And, in fact, I was told that was the most important thing I needed to know, and I didn't need to know anything else. And that's every bit as crippling as being told there's nothing wrong that's ever been done in this country, ever. Both views are equally crippling.
But do you understand the type of white person that's had more of a sheltered life, hasn't had to fight to get that job because their name sounded white? You know, there's a lot of hindrances that as a white person I never had to go through. I'll never have to go through.
Well, I'm going to tell you, the biggest single hindrance that I know of that black people in this country have ever experienced, the most detrimental behavior prospect for the detriment of their prospects and future in this country has been the Democrat Party and what it has done to the black community. No other single thing has harmed black people in this country more than the actions of the Democrat Party, and particularly what they've done to black people in the big cities of the United States. Nothing.
Recently or
Chicago
back in the past?
Most of my life and most of my relatives who lived in big cities and watching the corruption and everything else that limited the opportunities of black people and drove businesses out of the city so they couldn't get jobs and everything else they did and the great society and the destruction of the two-parent black family, believe me, nothing that hurt the black people outside of slavery was worse than what the Democrat Party did to black people.
It wasn't
Jim Crow, everything is all on them.
People.
The Ku Klux Klan, all of that is all on Democrats.
No, they're not. A lot of
yes,
the Klan
is
now Republican.
The Ku Klux Klan was the military wing of the Democrat Party. That is a fact. It was founded
Are
by
you
Democrats.
Are you talking the 1920s? Are you talking now?
I'm talking about in the 19th century and 20th century, it was founded by Confederate veterans who were Democrats in Pulaski, Tennessee, after the Civil War.
Right, I know. I've been to the national headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. Pardon, if you let me finish my thought, you might learn something. And I know you're a respecter of women. And you like to be heard, and you want to be valued.
Ma'am, I'm waiting for you to finish. I'm waiting for the last 10 seconds.
You just interrupted me.
Yes, and I waited 10 seconds for you to say anything.
Excuse-
I was looking at my watch.
You still have not progressed as a human, have you?
Okay, ma'am.
What
oh,
I was going to try
me,
to tell
you,
what I was trying to tell you, I can outscream you if you want me to.
Okay. I can definitely say I am a human being.
I can scream at you if you want. You're raising your voice to me. It's not very polite, and I want to finish my line.
Ma'am, I mean, are you going to be perpetually offended?
I did. I guess I'll have to sound it out because you're not able to listen. You know, please don't have a heart attack. I know you have heart issues.
You're the one calling me subhuman. I've done no such to you.
I've been to the national headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. I can tell you that they're Republicans. I can tell you that they worship Trump. I've been doing a piece on the Klan for freaking years.
Now, wait, whoa, hang on a second. So you're telling me that that they worship Trump, the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan, what,
they cried after he lost.
Today?
Which order of the Ku Klux Klan were you studying, ma'am? There are many of them, you know. They have many chapters.
Yes,
now, which
I know.
One were you studying? You said you were studying.
You're insulting
me, so
I'm not going to answer you on that. You speak to me.
Okay,
as
good,
a...
good. That's fine. You don't have to answer.
But the point of it is, though,
oh,
ma'am, but the point of it is, though, whether or not who worships the Ku Klux Klan really doesn't
they're
formulate the opinion.
They are really Republicans.
David Duke endorsed Joe Biden. David Duke endorsed Joe Biden.
He actually did, actually, believe it or not.
You know,
but,
my friend
but,
grew up in the same house that David Duke grew up in.
Okay.
Next.
He endorsed
right,
Joe
well,
Biden.
Well,
he was a Klansman in Louisiana who ran for the state Senate, state legislative seat there.
Louisiana
Klansmen
is a violent state when it
Donald
comes
Trump.
To the Klan.
Donald Trump is too
They're
close
still
to
very violent.
For most Klansmen.
Well, they
Klansmen
are. You have
don't
to
like Donald Trump as a rule.
Mm, I know I am.
They, yeah, they actually don't.
You know,
he, and the
he's
NSM
yelling
don't
so
either.
Loud. It's
but
hard.
Go ahead,
I don't
ma'am.
Like it when people talk at me.
Okay.
Yes,
and that's
I know.
What
you're
he has a tendency to do.
Madam, I'm very familiar with the species. After all, I'm subhuman, you know.
You weren't even listening.
Go ahead, ma'am. Go ahead. I'll give you the floor for a couple
Notice,
minutes.
Notice, she's insulted me twice now, and I haven't started
I, oh, I know.
On her yet. But she doesn't want to get
I know,
me
I know,
started.
I know. You're going to, and you charge, I know you're going to.
And believe me, you're
charge.
Not
going to
like
you're...
what you hear. If you think you're offended now, just wait a minute and insult me again.
So,
but that would mean I have to value your opinion. I most certainly do not, sir.
Jeez. No, go ahead, ma'am. Go, ma'am, go ahead. I'm not trying
yeah,
to put you down.
Because most of this program
you.
That I've been listening to, is you're spitting facts out, and you're talking at people. This lovely host that I've listened to before, because I like his show, there's no reason to talk at him. No reason at all.
Joe, did I talk at you? Do you think I talked to you? I mean, she's
I don't think
perception.
You have.
You
I don't think you have. You
are the one
that
I'm
my perception.
With. What do you think?
I think, well, in my opinion,
you're easy
in my opinion,
to react.
I,
you know, a child reacts, an adult responds.
Right, why don't we let Joe talk? Now who's interrupting? Go ahead, Joe.
Ma'am, with
what
all due respect,
think,
real,
yes,
with all due respect,
you?
Trying
with
to hear
respect,
you.
With all due respect, I respect your opinion, ma'am, but in fact, of the matter, I consider
sure.
Sarge a patriot, a well-informed, knowledgeable individual, and a fellow American that I value his opinion, and sometimes he has more to
oh,
say than
the
I
law
do,
enforcement.
And that's why I let him speak, that's all.
Well, I'm just saying he's also was in law enforcement. He's
yeah, well, she doesn't agree with
you.
He doesn't agree with you, so there. And so, you know, you have a difference
no,
with him.
No, there's a difference of opinion. That's
yes,
why he
you
had
have a
you on. He
not
stated
with me.
Why he had you on. I don't know what you heard, but that's what I heard.
Hey, again, ma'am, he doesn't think I'm talking to at him. You do.
No, I don't.
You and he share a different opinion, apparently, unless you think he's merely trying to accommodate me, which I don't think, because Joe Gibson is
no.
his own man.
Yeah.
Of course he
I
is.
I would not. but
yeah,
anyway,
I haven't heard you talk
clear.
In a long time, Sarge. You know, I understood you had a difficult time at one point, and I'm glad you're back. That's good. But you're still talking at people.
Ma'am,
no,
Sarge so,
doesn't
and neither does the person I would speak to. But you're free to have that opinion if you wish. I simply don't agree with you.
Yeah,
you
I don't
know,
agree
that's
with
a
that
response.
Either. I don't think he does.
That's not a reaction.
Ma'am, do you need
but
agreement
anyway,
from me, or can we just move on?
Yeah, I think I think
to agree
well,
to disagree and
was
move
asking
on.
Me
Are you questions on this or what?
When you butted in.
It's okay that we disagree. I prefer clarity
no,
to disagreement.
No, I said
you made
he was
clear.
Asking me questions
I made myself
when
clear.
You tried to
can
overtalk
we move on?
People.
Do we have to
like you always
without,
have before.
Do we both in some kind of agreement?
It's because I'm a woman.
You there
overtalk
you go.
Me.
That might have something to do with it, yeah. But I wouldn't dare approach
Well, no,
because
I know his style.
Yeah,
I don't think he can help himself. He's from an older generation. You know, he's
yeah,
retired
yeah,
from
yeah,
the police force.
I think Sarge respects women. Come on now. Come on now. I don't get
oh,
I've
no,
never gotten that.
In
I've
my
listened,
opinion.
I've actually had
so
conversations with Sarge on this podcast.
Feminism does
others.
Not impress
I'm
me
I'm trying to hear
much.
What Mr. Gibson was saying. Could you please be quiet for a second? Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Gibson.
Listen, I don't... obviously there's three different types of voices here, and then we have a woman, and we have two different types of other voices that you feel we have that may be offensive that you feel that are, but like, can we move on for, like, maybe get back to the problems we face and understanding the times in which we live today? Like,
sure.
You know, like what concerns you or what you see our country? Because I think, Sarge, I agree with Sarge. I agree with restoring the original republic, the Constitution, and getting back to the fundamentals and foundations of moral values of what we could stand upon. And no matter, even if we disagree, we have a common goal that gets us to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that we all can enjoy, no matter where we come from or what we look like or who we are.
Well, I went to a Democratic convention on Saturday. A state one lasted 17
okay.
hours. You know.
Okay.
And we have a lot of issues.
What was your take?
People do not understand Robert's rules of order or how to behave in a convention. I just jaw dropped. You know, it's just getting worse every year. I don't know how we turn back the clock. Maybe getting rid of critical race theory might be a good start.
I think Sarge will agree with you on that one.
Oh, do I
yeah.
ever. It's reformulated
yeah.
Marxism.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
Critical race theory.
Yeah, you know, I'm not in favor of that. But I think we need to bring back the grammars of math, the grammar of English, you know, the basic education also with the technology. That is what our kids need. They need a classical education. They need to learn their Latin root words. They don't know what Latin is.
True. True. You won't hear any argument with me on that one. How do we do it? How do we do it?
Well, I know in Oklahoma they outlawed teaching critical race theory. You cannot teach critical race theory in Oklahoma. And the teachers are not required to teach any history of minorities. That's the bad part of that law. The Tulsa Race Massacre. They made a law that you had to teach it, correct? And then now you don't, which was really bad timing because it was the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre. And I was documenting all those events. You know, I hope
what do you think about them? What do you think about those groups coming out saying kill everything white? What's up with that?
Oh, we had the new Black Panthers show up in Tulsa, and I came in from out of town to document all these events, and they brought almost 1,000 people with all their guns and marched through the streets of Tulsa. They did not stay within like the parade, you know, the parade area to commemorate the people that survived and the people that lost their lives, you know, 100 years ago. They just decided to make their own route. They went through downtown Tulsa. I mean, that was a trip. My friend made a video to just, because I wasn't at those streets. I was at a different part in Tulsa. But,
why weren't they met with protest,
though?
Why weren't they met with protest and opposition?
Because
you know,
they decided to take a different route. Let's say they decided that they were going to go on B Street. They didn't go down B Street where everybody thought they would be. They went down H Street. Do you understand what I'm saying? They weren't where they were supposed to be.
Yeah.
And the Tulsa police were not happy with them at all because their role is to keep everybody safe, make sure a car doesn't go through their group, things like that. And,
And imagine
wow.
if that would have happened, what riots would have happened, and with guns
Skip,
and whatnot,
Skip Morgan.
The powder keg. You know, but to
the
yell, kill white
channel
people,
is Skip
kill
Morgan.
Everything white.
You can see it. Pardon?
Yeah, but imagine if the Oath Keepers were out there saying, let's kill every black person, or let's take down the government and whatnot.
Oh,
imagine
the Klan was there. The Klan was there.
Oh, they were?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the richest Klan in the nation is in Tulsa. They have a billionaire that supports them.
But I disagree with their views and fundamental principles. As they, you know what, both of sides, actually, because you know what they're doing? They're playing
well,
the
tribal
game.
Well, they still have the right
game.
To be protected.
They have the right, yes, they
be
do. But to a certain point where they're talking about killing
what?
People, and that's
oh.
wrong, you know?
Well, that can take away your right for your First Amendment if you're going to incite a riot or to talk about violence to a specific group of people.
Well, yeah, but if you're talking about killing white people or killing black people, it's wrong. It's wrong, and that's not protected by
the law. They can take your right to free speech away for that.
No, they can never take your right to free speech away. Inciting violence is not free speech. They can never take your right of free speech away. Never.
But if you incite a
that's
violent
not free
mob.
Speech.
Well, I'm
no,
saying
that
if you
right
take
to a crime with
your
speech.
Right of free
if I
speech
tell
away,
you to kill someone,
if you know the
if
law,
I say, caller,
sir, if
take
you
your
know
gun and kill
the law.
This person standing next to you. That is not free speech. That is an incitement.
Your
that
First
is incitement
Amendment,
to commit
they can
murder.
Take that away from you if the, one of those two
speech.
Things happens.
See,
because they take it away
you
from you at that point.
Disorderly conduct can be a crime if you make a threat that is
even the Supreme Court decided that.
Disorderly conduct.
Yeah, but
the Supreme Court doesn't
make
law,
though. It is a crime.
Yeah, but the Supreme Court doesn't make law, though. They only rule on the opinion of
a particular
case. But they
backed up on a case that those two reasons that your free speech could be taken away.
Because a thing is speech does not mean it's free speech. Speech can be criminal.
Yes,
we can take the right
to
free speech away.
It
is the law.
If you call in a false bomb threat, that's not free speech. It is criminal.
You know, you're not my drill sergeant.
Press 1.
Ma'am, look, I'm going to explain to you. You keep saying that you can take away your... You can't take away anyone's rights.
It's the law. I keep telling
you,
it's the law.
You can never take it away.
It's very easy to find.
Well, let's get back. We got into the free speech thing. Okay, so the Klan showed up there. What happened? Nothing happened. All that happened is the people became more and more divided with their ideas of nonsense, because the globalists love this. The New World Order loves this. They love controlling and the narrative, and we're playing against each other, our hatred or division or whatnot, which sometimes maybe it's justified. I don't know. But the same fact of the matter is individual battles and tribalism does not work. We have to look at the bigger picture. They're trying to destroy our individual sovereignty, our freedom, our liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And when they take that away, when they take away our rights, like you just said, our free speech, when they try, no matter what avenue they're going down, by how they're doing it, we have to stop this attacking each other. We need to start waking up and understanding that there's a bigger fish here in the game that we have to catch and reel in, because the globalists are winning. It's an information war, and they're winning. Well, I got silence here for a minute.
I don't know if they're really winning, because when their ideas are subjected to tests, they don't pass muster. What they're doing is dominating. There's not enough for speech to counter what they do. They control the high ground of the media, entertainment, culture, academia, and the press. They've got the most voices, the widest voices, and most people get their information from these big media sources. So they dominate. I don't think they win, because when their ideas are subjected to ours, they lose.
But if they keep dominating, they're going to eliminate us, and they're going to win. And we don't want them to win and eliminate our individual freedoms. And because America is the last stand here on this planet. We covered that earlier. And that's why I was playing the George Washington, the Andrew Jackson, the documentaries, because that needs to be told, no matter I get a couple thousand people to listen to it, if I get 50 people to listen to it, it's still out there, and it refreshes our minds. Like you said, Sarge, thank you for playing George Washington, because it refreshes our minds. You know, and we need that out there, because the schools aren't teaching it no more. We're not talking about it in the coffee shops, to stand in line at the grocery store, at Walmart, when you talk to your neighbor next door. We're not talking about it. So someone has to, and we need to remember our foundations and what we were founded upon.
Well, Joe, what they're teaching is they are teaching about George Washington, but they're teaching the only important thing you need to know about him is that he had false teeth. And he has slaves. And that's it. Yeah, they are teaching about George Washington. They're not teaching the whole story about George Washington or the most important things about him.
You got that right.
Like the false teeth are made of slave teeth. Like
no,
that.
They weren't. No, they weren't.
Yes, they were. I've seen them.
No, they weren't.
I've seen them.
They were
made
of
human
teeth. No, they were made of cow teeth, horse teeth, and yes, he put advertisements in
the paper. Have you seen the teeth? I have seen the teeth.
Yeah,
those were not cow teeth.
He put advertisements.
And he had more than one
in,
pair.
All
and
right,
he paid the slaves for their teeth.
He put. It was common at the time to put advertisements in the paper for teeth to make dentures. That's what he did. It's established.
He
we got the records.
Paid
we got the
his slaves
from the
for
period
their
at Mount,
teeth.
Mount Vernon. You can look it up yourself.
Actually,
there was
you know
an
what,
exhibit,
George,
and it had
he
three different pairs of his teeth.
Them.
Oh,
you know,
my Lord, would you, I don't know why I tried to have
if George
a discussion
Washington had
with you.
It doesn't matter what George Washington's teeth were made of. It just you know what matters is the man's character, his courage, and what he did to establish winning freedom and going up against the greatest military machine that was on planet Earth at that time, and that was the British Empire. And he stood against that as a general, and then he was our first president. And the humility that he showed by not accepting a third term or becoming a king was absolutely something that nobody would do today, I would think, if they were in that same position. In my opinion, from what I see from the character of what we have in our so-called leaders or politicians. But, Sarge, to wrap up the podcast here, everybody can get closing thoughts here. I'll go at 918 first, and Sarge, you can get the last word. Anybody else wants to chip in here?
No, please. He always wants to talk over me. Let him go first.
You want him to
and
go first?
And then please mute him.
Tell you
well,
what.
You are
yes, I would love that.
Ladies first.
What? Look, ladies first.
No.
The ladies
you go first,
okay,
because you'll talk
to,
over
madam.
Me, and I'm
why
not having that.
Why are you taking advantage of being deferred to?
Because you talk over people. I
it's
want you muted after you're done.
I'm perpetually offended. Yes, I do.
So why would I be talked over if I could avoid it?
Okay, so you don't want to say anything then?
So please, you go first. I'll go second, and you will be muted.
We toss a coin. Joe, why don't you make the decisions? This is your show. Who goes
I'll
first?
Tell you what. How about I go first? How about that? How about that?
Okay. That
you know
great.
What?
Hey,
we
just
solved the problem.
I'm going to leave it up
hey,
to you because you're the boss here. Okay, who goes after you? You want me to go after
I'll
you?
Go first. I'll go first. I'll tell you what. Well, she doesn't want to go first, so I'm going to go first. And then I'm going to say she goes second. But, Sarge, you can't interrupt her, though. How about
no,
that?
I will go third because she will talk over
boy.
Me, and I'm not having that.
Well, we got to have a vote here.
You? How am I going to talk over you if I don't say anything while you speak? I promise I won't.
What if he promises not to interrupt you at one time? One time.
He cannot help himself.
I won't interrupt you when you speak.
And he talks loud because he can't hear well. And he doesn't
see,
realize
here we go
he's
again.
Talking loud.
He doesn't listen.
I'm not
going to
be yelled
I swear
at.
On George Washington's soul and my mother's that I won't interrupt you when you make your concluding statement.
You can't
no,
beat that
you're not
going to
strong-arm me into that. No.
No, that was a kind...
are we
going
to bring up the woman? I think now it's time to bring up the woman thing, don't you?
Let's
I'm
go
sorry,
ahead.
But that is classic.
I guess, why not? What the heck, man? I mean, you know what? I mean, I don't know. I'll tell you what. I'm going to stay out of this. You guys duke
it
out.
Okay, I'll go after you, Joe. You go ahead,
it?
I'll go after you. Because please, let's please this woman, for God's sake.
You know what? They say in the end times, women will rule over their men, you know?
Sarge, what would your late wife say? Nothing, because
okay.
She never let
again, madam, your wish is my command. Joe, you go ahead first. I'll go right after you.
All right, thank you. Hey, everybody, anybody who wants to participate here tonight in the closing thoughts of this podcast, we did do a documentary on George Washington. It was a good documentary. Last night we did Andrew Jackson. Thank you for listening and participating in the podcast, understanding the times in which we live today. It's so very important to, you know, reflect back on the founders of this country, restore our republic, because today we are losing the foundations to which we built our republic upon. We see that every single day, so... thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it. And, Sarge, now on to you.
Yeah, good on you, Joe. Like I said, you did a good job tonight with this show. I think it's vitally important we remember the true history of the United States in context, and in particular the people to whom we owe this country's existence and the tremendous prosperity that most of us enjoy, along with a good measure of liberty, however attenuated in these modern times, we would not enjoy were it not for people like George Washington, who created this great country after having guided it through enormous periods of incredible turmoil. So with that, I will turn it over to 918.
Liberty and freedom are two different things. Liberty is innate, and freedom is something that you can be granted or it can be taken away from you. I think that's important for today's society to remember. Now, what these two people don't know is I am from one of those founding families. You know, Patrick Jefferson surveyed our lands, so Thomas, his son, was our neighbor, but we were part of the Commonwealth as well. So I have a unique perspective on slavery in those days. It was wrong then, and looking back at it, it should still be wrong. It was inhumane, and we need to recognize that the founding fathers were full of sin. And I'm concluded. Thank you.
All right, 918, thank you so much for participating in tonight's podcast. She's got a powerful voice, Sarge. I will admit that. And she seems like she knows what she's talking about. I mean, I may disagree with her on some things, but you know what? I will respect her and what she had to say. I got someone else here who wants to jump in here real quick. So
thank you.
But you're welcome. 909, go ahead.
Hi, Joseph. It's Suzette. Hi, Sarge.
Hi, Suzette. How are you? Hi, Suzette. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing all right. All right, just listening to the show. I just want to say, as far as our country goes, so often over the last decade, and more, you know, even a little bit before that, but more so now than ever, we just keep hearing that we need to understand that slavery is bad, and that our founding was on slavery, or built on the backs of slavery. And it's like, what do you mean we need to understand? That's all we talk about. It's in our face every day, and the founding wasn't on slavery. The slavery had come later. It's never good, whether, you know, slavery, or indentured slavery, or any type of slavery for that matter. But the important part is that we do understand that slavery is bad. That's why we moved past it. That's why the founding and the courts decided to get rid of it, abolish it. You know, we had a civil war that wasn't because of it, but there was a result that came out of it that, you know, worked towards abolishing or did abolish the slavery trade. And so that alone, you know, shows that we understand that it's bad. Otherwise, it would have never been done. And the fact that back then, you know, slaves would have, they did everything in their power to educate themselves quietly, in the dark, in the shadows, because they were not allowed to learn. And now the opportunity to learn is everywhere. You can get free college actually online. You have to pay for your diploma afterwards, or your certificate, depending on what courses that you take, but the classes themselves are free, you know, or if you make the grade to get a scholarship to go to college, that means you have to work hard to get there, but it's paid for, you know, through scholarships and other means. And or if you have the money to pay for it, or maybe you go to trade school. But the education is open. The opportunity is there. Nobody's preventing anybody from using that opportunity to better themselves. So I don't understand why people keep saying, we need to understand that slavery is bad and you know, that it still exists in the world. Well, for that matter, you could say everybody's a slave, whoever has a job, because they are employed and they get paid for labor that they perform, whether it be behind a desk or in a manufacturing company or in the fields.
Good point.
But it's rather an exchange, my labor, and you're going to pay me for it. How much am I worth? If you're not going to pay me what I think I'm worth, I'll go someplace else and see if somebody else will. You don't have to stay there at that job and take those wages. It's a free market system. It doesn't work for everybody right now because it's a crony capitalist system. It went wrong. We can fix that or work towards fixing it to where there isn't such a large wage gap, or, you know, as far as money goes between the rich and the poor, and fix it in the way it's supposed to work with the free market system rather than crony. But that doesn't involve, that has nothing to do with slavery. It just means that we've got a bunch of corrupt people that have taken advantage of the politicians, and the politicians, of course, got their hands greased for doing so. And so that we've got to stop that. And so anyway, that's my thoughts. I think that the opportunities that we have in this country apply to everybody who's willing to take them, even the ones that are crossing the borders unfavorably or illegally, have those opportunities available to them. So I don't understand why we need to understand something we understand and dealt with a while ago. Back to you.
Thank you, Suzette. Thank you. And I apologize. I apologize for not getting back to you last week. I've just been swamped and whatnot. I do have your number written down. I mean, I promise I'll give you a call because I want to get you those two books, Reinhabited. I don't know if you ordered them already, but I swear I have not forgotten you. I mean, I apologize. I really do. You know, it's just I've just been like so bad. I got so much going on. I don't want to get into my personal aspects of my life, but I just really got a lot going on. But, okay. You know, so I just wanted to let you know that. But thanks for checking in tonight and listening to the podcast. Okay. Thank you. I mean, because you always offer a very intelligent voice to the show. You never say anything off. I mean, like, I was talking about you the other day, actually. One of the callers that was conversing with you on my last show that you were on said, you know, he admired what you're doing and what, you know, how you're going about it, and you're obviously very intelligent. You know what's going on, and we need more people like you. We need more women like you, plain and period, out there fighting. And that's so. Thank you for everything that you do.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome, Sarge. Or anybody else want to say something here at the end? Here, we got a couple minutes left. I got 2 minutes left. I don't like to play anything for anybody.
I got one thing to say to all those people out there who have the benefit of moral hindsight and. You know, 2021 moral hindsight, and sit on their moral high horses and look down upon the slave owners and people who did not realize or take action on the certain knowledge that slavery was a moral sin. If you are a supporter of the unrestricted slaughter of innocent lives in the womb for no reason, for reasons other than the therapeutic medical reason, which, by the way, I do support, but if you support anything else, the taking of innocent human life for any other reason, I would suggest to you that perhaps 50, 60, 100 years hence, when and if a moral center is ever restored to the world, those people will look back upon you and say, how could you support such an unrestricted slaughter of innocent human beings, much as we today look upon with, in many cases, horror of the slave-owning people of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. Just saying.
Slavery still exists today in America.
Not in the United States, it doesn't, unless it's illegal aliens bringing human trafficking across the border.
They buy and sell boys from Seattle, a certain oil company does. Because slavery is still here. You just don't see it.
You
just don't see it.
I guess. I think
it's illegal. It's illegal.
They are committing a crime.
I'm telling you, slavery still exists.
Okay, I will accept your notion that slavery exists. If they are doing it, they're committing a crime just like bank robbers.
Yes. Yes, they are. It's illegal.
Then we need to arrest them. Find out who they are, arrest them, and prosecute them. It's not the country's fault that they're doing it.
Oh, my gosh.
They're going to cut me off any second.
It's a system.
Hey, just some...
And there's still plantations in Louisiana that hold slaves.
Well,
they keep
there's
them
slavery
from
all over the world. There's human
they
trafficking
don't pay
going
them.
On. That's horrible. It's horrible what's going on around the world, especially the sex
in Louisiana.
Trafficking and whatnot. I mean, that needs to be
in
exposed.
Louisiana.
Then bring
it happens here in North Carolina.
And what they're
you
doing
know?
Is
so,
illegal.
You know, it is illegal.
That's
and
up
everyone,
to the
you know, we have to stop it.
State.
As a people, as fellow human beings, I mean, what's going on around the world is just disgusting. We can all agree on that, you
mm-hmm.
know. So that's why we do these podcasts, I guess, to try to wake people up. So, but thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I appreciate it. God bless. Take care and support the Republic and our original Constitution and be good out there.